Yeah, so this is about 2:31, and it's September 19th, Monday. We're going to finish up axial skeleton. And don't forget, Blackboard is down. But nonetheless, you still have a quiz due tomorrow night, but Blackboard should come up way before then, probably this afternoon sometime. But if it doesn't, that's easy. What's an easy fix for that? I'll just give everybody a zero for that quiz, okay? So, no, I'm just kidding. We'll figure something out. I'll have to reprogram and extend the deadlines for that if Blackboard doesn't come back up or causes problems with the quiz environment. I'm not sure. All right, so I think I got this thing going. All right, so appendicular skeleton. What are the bones, or what are the two main regions of the appendicular skeleton? You got your arms, okay, your upper appendages and your lower appendages. And your axial skeleton is made up of your skull, vertebral column, and rib cage. And so there have to be bones that attach your appendages to your axial skeleton. And this is what we were talking about last time. These bones are what we call girdles because they completely surround the cavities in that region of your body. So the pectoral girdle refers to the bones that surround your thoracic cage, and especially the superior regions of the thoracic cage that help attach your upper appendage to the axial skeleton. And those bones of the pectoral girdle are the clavicle and the scapula. All right, so where would you group the clavicle and scapula? In appendicular skeleton or axial skeleton? They're appendicular skeleton bones. They're just a special part of it because they attach your upper appendage to your axial skeleton. And here is that joint. This is the only joint that is holding your upper appendage to your axial skeleton. And it's what? The manubrial clavicular joint right here. Just that one little joint. But you have lots of muscles. And now you're probably really interested in knowing all these muscles that hold your arm to your body, but we're not going to get to that this week, okay? But we'll get to it the week after that. And we got a test coming up after the next set of practicums, which is starting next week, right? So no lecture test next week, but you got some practicums, and then we're going to go back to bones the week after and take the second lecture exam on bones. All right, so you got clavicle and scapula right here. So the things that you have to know are pretty much in your lab list. So here's a nice clavicle. If you just look at a clavicle, you see that it's a nice S-shaped bone, and either ends are kind of flared out. All right, so both the acromial end, which articulates with the scapula, and the sternal end, which articulates with the manubrium, have big flares. But this bone, when you look at it in real life, the two ends are radically different from each other. In this picture, they look pretty similar, but, and I don't have a picture to show you, and it kind of underscores why lab is so important, because if you look at just an anterior view, right, looking from this direction toward the scapula, you're going to see that the acromial end is very, very flat, but the sternal end is still very thick. So if you look at it from on edge, the sternal end looks like the opening of a clarinet or trumpet, something like that. But the acromial end of the clavicle right here just kind of looks like a knife blade because it's really, really thin. It's only in one dimension that this end flares out. So the scapula, the clavicle is still pretty easy to appreciate, but you got to look at it in real life. Right? The only other thing that you have to know about this clavicle right here is this tubercle, which helps stabilize the shoulder joint. This is what the acromial end. Right, the scapula, on the other hand, is a pretty easy bone to know because you can pick it up in lab and model it on your body. It fits very nicely. And the lateral edge of this bone, you have a nice depression which holds the head of the humerus. And so this is what we call the glenoid cavity or glenoid fossa. It's not a very deep depression, so you have a lot of range of motion at the shoulder. But unfortunately, okay, because you have a lot of range of motion and the glenoid cavity is relatively shallow, it means that it's a relatively weak joint. The shoulder joint can be damaged fairly easily compared to the corresponding joint for the lower appendage, which is the hip joint. So on the anterior side of the scapula, we have the subscapular fossa. right? And we have a nice long medial border, a shorter lateral border, because part of it's taken up with the glenoid cavity and the superior border on the top. You got a superior angle, inferior angle, so it's really easy to figure out how to position the scapula inside your body. On the posterior side, there is a prominent bony ridge that we call the spine of the scapula. So spine is a long, narrow process. Above the spine, you have the supraspinous fossa. Down below it, the infraspinous fossa. And at the lateral end of the spine of the scapula, you got the acromion process. And these are all for muscle attachment and for ligament attachments. So again, I want to re-emphasize how important it is for you to know your bones. Because when you know the structures of bones, you learn what automatically? Vascular anatomy, right? Neuroanatomy, muscle anatomy. So let's go over some other kinds of anatomy. In the supraspinous fossa right here, what's the function of a fossa before we get there? What's the function of a fossa? It's for holding something. So, and it holds a muscle. And now you know the name of the muscle that is in this part of your body. That's going to be the supraspinatus in this fossa right here. And then in the infraspinous fossa, that's going to be the infraspinatus. Right? And then in what's the other fossa? On the anterior side, that's the subscapular fossa. So the name of this muscle is going to be the subscapularis. You don't have to know this for the next test in lecture, but when we get to muscles, you will. And if you remember something about the scapula, then it's going to make knowing the names of these muscles really trivial. Right? So please don't forget any names of your bones, because they're on your lab list, because they're going to be helpful for you to know when we get to other parts of the class. Right, so we're not just trying to make you memorize a bunch of independent facts, but hopefully some important facts that relate to other important structures in your body so that you have an understanding of how your body is put together. So there are four fossa on the scapula that you have to know something about. On the anterior side is the subscapular fossa. On the posterior side, you got supraspinatus and infraspinatus, which probably should make perfect sense at this point in the class. And then laterally, there's another fossa. What's the fourth fossa? The? Okay, for an extra credit point, tell me. Glenoid. All right, you guys are still there. Okay, glenoid fossa right here. And glenoid cavity and glenoid fossa mean exactly the same thing. Okay. So that's the scapula. So how many bones do you have in your arm?
One.
You got one, which is the humerus, and I can see it right here. Right here is the proximal epiphysis, distal epiphysis. Oh, I think we went over this last time. We did. The proximal epiphysis is pretty easy to understand. Right, and then mid-diaphysis, you have the deltoid tuberosity, which is the insertion for what muscle? A deltoid muscle, again, that kind of underscores how important it is to know your bones. Right. Here you have the anatomic neck, and then below the tubercles, you have a narrowing of the humerus. This is a place where it has a tendency to fracture, this narrow region, not the narrowing that we see here at the anatomic neck, because it's still a pretty massive bone right there. So this area is what we call the surgical neck. So it's the narrow part close to the epiphysis, and that's the place where it has a tendency to fracture. Down over here on the distal epiphysis, we have a number of articulating surfaces. We have the capitulum and trochlea. Right, so there are two articulating surfaces. Take a guess. How many bones are in the forearm? There are two. Okay, there are two in the forearm. That's why we have these two articulating surfaces. Right, so when we look at the humerus, we see the head of the humerus right here. So is this the medial edge or lateral edge? That's the medial edge, because the head of the humerus is attaching to the glenoid cavity, which is medial. Right, so this right here, the trochlea, is the more medial articulating surface. That's going to articulate with the ulna. And laterally, the capitulum is going to articulate with the radius. And you've got to look at that a number of times so that it's just like second nature. You don't even have to think about it, okay? Because you're going to have questions on the practicum and lecture exam about that. And in particular, where does the trochlea articulate with the ulna? It's going to be a notch in the ulna, and that notch is going to be called the trochlear notch, right? So there's a nice relationship right there. The capitulum, on the other hand, is going to articulate with the head of the radius. not the capitular notch or anything like that, but the head of the radius. We see some ridges above the articulating surfaces. Sometimes an articulating surface on a bone is called a, what's it called sometimes? A condyle, right? So epicondyle means some bony thing located where? Above a condyle, right? So here you see the medial epicondyle, lateral epicondyle right here. Usually these are for muscle attachments. Anybody ever hear of epicondylitis? I hope you don't ever get that. Epicondylitis or tennis elbow, when somebody uses their arm, then the insertions of various muscles, okay, on the humerus right here become inflamed, and then it's hard to use the person's forearm when that happens. They have a lot of pain inhibition. And sometimes that can take weeks to clear up. And usually rest is one of the best activities. But if you're an athlete, do you have time to rest? No, you don't have time to rest, right? So sometimes it can be a nagging problem for people. All right, so here we have a fossa. Here we have another fossa. The radial fossa is going to be lateral compared to the coronoid fossa. These are going to accept certain parts of the radius and ulna, depending on what motion the elbow is going through. All right, so if you think of your elbow, you have a memorable spot on your elbow. Can you point to some memorable spot on your elbow? You're going to think of that thing that you bang all the time, okay? And every once in a while, you might even compress a nerve that goes right through there, all right? But that bony prominence is on the ulna. It's called the olecranon process. And when you straighten your arm out, just like that, what happens to that bony prominence, that bony point? It disappears. Okay, where does it go? It's got to go someplace. And it goes into this deep depression in the posterior side of the humerus that we call the olecranon fossa. So fortunately, the process and the fossa match up really nicely. All right, and of the two articulating surfaces on the humerus, which one did we say articulates with the ulna? Was it the capitulum or the trochlea? And it's the trochlea. And voila, the olecranon process is just superior to the trochlea. So that makes perfect sense as well. All right, if we flip back to the previous slide, these other two fossa right here, the radial fossa, right, is a depression. When you bend your arm like this, we call that flexion. The head of the radius has to fit into a little fossa right here. And then there's another process on the ulna. Remember, ulna and trochlea match up. We call this the coronoid fossa because there's a coronoid process on the ulna that has to fit into this depression right here. That's why we have these depressions. All right, so let's look at the joint in a little bit more detail. So here's the elbow joint. We got the thing that looks like a sphere, which is the capitulum. It articulates with the radius. And is that medial or lateral? Right here, medial or lateral. The slide will tell you, all right, but that's lateral. So what I'm trying to have you become a little bit familiar with is in the forearm, in anatomic position, the thumbs are lateral. Right, and that's going to match up with the radius bone in the forearm. The ulna is going to be medial. So here is the head of the radius, and you can see it fitting in very nicely with the capitulum. And then medially is the ulna. Here is the coronoid process, so that when you flex your elbow, this big bony prominence right here, which is for muscle attachment, has to fit into the coronoid fossa so that the ulna doesn't break or the humerus doesn't break. All right, so can you see the trochlea right here in capitulum? Let's look at maybe a inferior view. So here is the olecranon process of the ulna fitting into the olecranon fossa of the humerus. All right, and then the nice head of the radius articulating with the capitulum. So you got to know which articulating surface on the humerus does the head of the radius articulate with? What part of the humerus does the head of the radius articulate with? The capitulum. Even though it's not on the slide right here in your book, you might even want to label that. And what about the ulna? What does the ulna articulate with? It is the trochlea, which is right here. Okay, so in lab, put these bones together so that it will make perfect sense to you. Right? Because then you'll be able to actually flex and extend that joint as well. All right, well, let's take a look at these bones. So laterally, we have the radius. Notice that the head of the radius is proximal. The head of the ulna is distal. And the heads of these two bones are the narrow points. Right? The distal part of the radius down over here is what? Massive. It's big and massive. It helps form the wrist joint. There's a ligament that goes between the radius and the ulna. And this ligament right here only mildly stabilizes this bone-to-bone connection. Some ligaments make the joints between bones immovable, but this interosseous membrane allows for motion between these two bones. Like what kind of motion? Okay? And we don't know the names of this motion yet, but your palms in anatomic position are facing anteriorly, but what else can you do? You can make the palms face posteriorly like that. So the bones of the forearm actually cross over each other, and so that interosseous membrane doesn't prevent that motion from taking place. All right, here's that point on your elbow. That's the olecranon process. Below it is the coronoid process, and in between there's going to be a notch like a fish hook. All right, and that's what we call the trochlear notch. And what articulates within the trochlear notch? The trochlea. On which bone? The humerus, right? And where's that going to be on the humerus? Medial or lateral? Okay, and since it's the ulna, it's going to be medial. So what's an easy way, at least for me, to memorize which bone is medial and lateral in the forearm? Because I'm used to taking a pulse. Okay, with your index finger and your big finger, and you can feel somebody's pulse right there. And a lot of times people will say, well, let's get a radial pulse on somebody. So what does that mean? Just right above the thumb, palpate for a pulse right there. And why do they call that a radial pulse? Do I have like bicycle spokes coming out of me? No. Because that's the radius bone right there. And the name of the artery that courses down the radius bone is the radial artery, right? So again, really try to remember the names of all your bones and pieces of bones, because it makes a lot of sense when we get to other parts of the body. So that's the radial pulse, right about in this location right here. Okay, so these bones can cross over each other, so there is a special articulation between the head of the radius and the ulna. There is a special depression right in here that accepts the head of the radius, and we call that the radial notch. On what bone? The radial notch is on the ulna, right? And there's a corresponding notch over here that accepts the head of the ulna. So it's on the radius, but nonetheless, what do we call that notch? We don't call it the radial notch. That is the ulnar notch. So these features on bones are not named after the bone that they exist on, but the bones that they articulate with, right? So can you, in your mind, do you have a picture of the zygomatic arch? Zygomatic arch, there's a process on the temporal bone, okay, and it's reaching over and touching the zygomatic bone. That's part of the zygomatic arch. So what do you call that part of the temporal bone that is touching the zygomatic bone? It's a part of the zygomatic arch. Do you name it after the bone that it's on or after the bone that it is touching? After the bone that it's touching. So it's what? The zygomatic process of the temporal bone. Right, so these things here, this is the ulnar notch on the radius, and up over here is going to be the radial notch on the ulna. The same kind of nomenclature is being used. All right, so here's a zoomed in illustration of the proximal epiphysis of the ulna. So here's the olecranon process. Oh, what's the function of olecranon process? Muscle attachment. Yeah, you're always going to say muscle attachment. We're going to see a big, powerful muscle attaches right here for extension, namely the triceps. Okay, and then the coronoid process over here is for muscle attachment as well, for flexion at the elbow, and in between is that trochlear notch that articulates with what? The trochlea on the humerus. And then here is that nice radial notch. So in lab, make sure you palpate these nice articulating surfaces with your fingertips so you get a good appreciation of them. And then here is the corresponding ulnar notch in the radius. Okay, so that's bones of the forearm. So let's go to the wrist. Here are how the bones kind of match up in your body. Which one is the more massive bone of the forearm bones in your wrist? It is the radius. Yeah, that's a really big bone compared to the ulna. Okay. So here probably is an exam figure, I would guess, right here. And we see a hand. And there are three sets of bones that make up the hand. And we can see the radius again and the ulna. These are just little styloid processes on respectively the ulna and the radius right here. All right, the first set of bones right here make up the wrist. There are eight of them, and these make up a group of bones that we call carpals. You don't have to know the names. There's two rows. There's a proximal and distal row. We don't ask you to know the names of all of these bones, but if you have a family member that has problems with their wrist, or if you're interested, then it's probably a good idea to know the names of all of these. But on a test, you have to know these are carpals compared to other kinds of names of groups of bones in your body. And in particular, this one right here, here's one you do have to know the name of. It's just distal to the radius. And when people fall and catch themselves with their hands when they're falling backwards or even falling forwards, right, this is a small bone, and it's compressed by the radius. And what about the radius right here? It's big and strong and massive. It has a tendency to fracture this one right here. And it's called the scaphoid. So the scaphoid is kind of noteworthy that way, but it's also noteworthy because there's a thin area to the scaphoid right here that has a tendency to fracture, and there's a big artery that goes through that place, so that when the scaphoid is fractured, that blood vessel has a tendency never to regenerate, in which case, what happens to the bone? It dies because it loses its oxygen and nutrient supply. And when a bone dies, it just dissolves away. So you can imagine what function the wrist will have when you lose completely one of the bones in the wrist. Well, then you have a deficit in that joint. And it's something that typically happens, unfortunately. Okay, so all these bones are carpals. Then we get the bones of the hand right here. These are long bones. And guess how many bones you have in the hand proper. You've got five, all right? And these things are called metacarpals. So these are distal to the carpals. These are all metacarpals. They don't have names, but they're given numbers starting with the digit that you would use for hitchhiking, which is your great thumb, okay? Great digit on your hand, your thumb. That's number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So could anybody tell me the name of this bone where my cursor is hovering over right now? Is the number 4 what? Number 4? Metacarpal. Yeah, number 4 metacarpal. Here's a number 1 metacarpal. Here's a number 5 metacarpal. Right, so just count from the thumb over. That seems really easy, and it is. All right, now we're out of the hand, and we're into what part of your body here? These are your digits, right? So all of these extremities are your digits. There are bones in the digits, and all of the bones in the digits are called phalanges. So the bones are phalanges. The phalanges make up digits, or I suppose you could say fingers, but digits is a much better way to go. And you've got a lot of phalanges here. Okay. In digit number 1, which is your thumb, there's only 2. You've got a proximal and a distal phalanx. So phalanx is singular. And then number 2, 3, 4, and 5, how many bones do you see? 1, 2, 3. You got a proximal, middle, and distal phalanx. Right? And all of these are what we call phalanges. So what would you call this bone right here where the cursor is hovering over? Start with a number. It's number 4. Which one? Middle phalanx. Yeah. Could that be a metacarpal? No, because it's making a digit, not your hand. Right? So there's a pretty big difference. All right, so in digit number 1, you only have 2 phalanges, but in 2, 3, 4, and 5, you've got 3. That's the only little complication, but if this is an exam figure, then the exam figure is a key to your understanding, right? Then you can't get mixed up on that. Okay. All right, so that's the upper appendage. Who's got a question on this? We kind of belabored the point of the articulating surfaces on the elbow, because it's a little complicated. It's easy to forget, but don't forget about the radial fossa and ulnar fossa, or notch. They're called notches in your book. Where do you find the radial notch? On what bone is the radial notch? It's on the ulna. Where is the ulnar notch? It's on the radius. That's right. So even if it doesn't come to mind, probably you should be able to figure that out just by knowing some nomenclature. All right, so what holds this whole mess to your body? What holds this whole upper appendage to your body? That's part of the appendicular skeleton. It's the pectoral girdle, right? And how many bones are in the pectoral girdle on one side? On one side of your body, how many bones are there? There are two, the clavicle and scapula, and it's called the girdle because they do what? They completely surround your thoracic cavity, right? And it attaches your upper appendage to the axial skeleton. Well, there's a corresponding bone, right, that forms a girdle that helps attach your lower appendage to your axial skeleton. Okay, and remember, axial skeleton is what? Skull, vertebral column, and rib cage, including ribs and the sternum. And here's the sacrum. Of all those bones I mentioned, where does the sacrum belong? It's part of what? The vertebral column, right? It's a distal part of the vertebral column, so it's axial skeleton. And we can see now the hip bones here attaching to the vertebral column at the sacrum. And what do these hip bones do? They completely surround the pelvic cavity, so that's a girdle. And since they surround the pelvic cavity, we call that the pelvic girdle. Right, so the hip bones help make up the pelvic girdle. There are three bones that come together, that fuse together to form a hip bone. And a hip bone has got a couple different names. Sometimes it's called a coxal bone, and sometimes it's called an os coxae, two words, os coxae, all the same thing. So it goes from here all the way back to the sacrum. That's an os coxae. So you have two os coxae. If we put two os coxae together with a sacrum, sometimes we call that a pelvis, right? And in lab, you're going to see there's a male pelvis and a female pelvis, as long as it has that sacrum right in here, and the coccyx too. All right, so the superior bone during development, which eventually fuses with two other bones to make an os coxae, is called the ilium. The inferior bone, and this is the one that you're sitting on right now, this is the ischium. And then an anterior bone is the pubic bone. So these are three, and usually we can see the lines of fusion right inside this depression, which holds the head of the femur. And this depression right here is not called a glenoid cavity. This is called an acetabulum. But it can be considered a cavity or a fossa, just like on the scapula. And another similarity is, which way is this acetabulum facing? Is it medial or lateral? It's facing laterally because your bone in the thigh is the femur, and the head is going to be pointing medially into the acetabulum right here. All right, so the os coxae is probably the most intimidating bone in this group. There are a lot of exercises in Blackboard for dragging and dropping, okay, naming these processes right here. I think all of these are in your lab list to know. But let's start with the bones. How many bones have fused together to make an os coxae? There are three superiorly right here, and you can kind of feel that on your hip, all right? And that is the ilium, and then the one you're sitting on is the ischium, and the one in the front is the pubic bone. Pubic bone is the smallest one. The ilium is the largest. All right, so let's look at, well, let's consider this just a little bit longer. All right, is this a lateral or medial view? All right, superior is at the top, inferior is at the bottom. So somebody placed this picture nice already in that respect. We don't have to turn it around. But lateral or medial view, and how would you know? Lateral because I see the acetabulum right here. And in real life, in the bones that we have, you're going to see that's a really nice deep fossa. So the hip joint is really strong because this fossa right here is really, really deep. The femur inserts into the os coxae very deeply. This thing that looks like a fan or a wing on the ilium is called the ala. Okay, on top of that is the iliac crest. And that's for all muscle attachment. So why do you think this os coxae is so big and massive? Because there are big, massive, strong muscles that attach to it, right? And it's holding up all your body weight. So it's got to be a big, strong bone. And that's why in a lot of bones you don't even see these lines of fusion anymore, because they're completely ossified together, and they're even hard to see. Okay, so the ala kind of looks like this wing. I see some processes here and here. I see two processes here and here. So there are I wish I could use my fingers and go like this, right? But there's two over here and two over here. The anterior bone in an ostococci is the pubic bone. So this is the anterior side, and this is the posterior side, right? And that kind of explains why you're sitting on this one up over here. All right, so if this is the anterior side, here is a spine on the ilium, right? So remember, the name of this bone is the ilium. And then here is the inferior iliac spine. But what side of the ilium is this? This is the anterior. So here, anterior superior iliac spine, anterior inferior. So the key to knowing these two is to know that the pubic bone is anterior, right? Superior and inferior is not hard to know. And the ilium is not hard to know. All right, let's go to the posterior side. These two processes right here. So you've got posterior, because it's the posterior side of the bone, superior, and posterior inferior iliac spine. Because what bone are these processes on? What bone? The ilium right here, right? All right, so the posterior also has another nice landmark that's easy to see, and that's this big notch right here. That's what we call the sciatic notch. And take a guess, what nerve goes through here? Sciatic nerve goes through here. Here's another landmark. Here is, what do we call this thing? It's a hole, but in anatomy that doesn't get you any points. That's called a foramen, okay? And it's called the It's called the obturator foramen. Uh-oh, how about this slide? Ah, yeah, here it is, obturator foramen. We just took a little deviation to a medial view of the bone. So there's, let's go back. Obturator foramen, take a guess at what nerve goes through here. Obturator nerve goes right through here. Okay, so greater sciatic notch, lesser sciatic notch. But as we jump from this greater sciatic notch to the lesser sciatic notch, we jump from the ilium to which bone? The ischium. So this spine right here is not an iliac spine. This is an ischial spine. And we don't have a superior or anterior or posterior. We just have one. So we just call this the ischial spine. And on either side, you have the greater sciatic notch, and then on the inferior side, you've got the lesser sciatic notch. Okay. So I would say students have some tendency to forget that this is the ischium and label this the ilium spine, right? But it's not. It's an ischial spine. Where do you find the iliac spines? Up over here and over here. But that's a pretty prominent landmark on this particular bone. All right, so in this region, you have the body of the ilium. This region is the body of the ischium, and this region here is the body of the pubic bone. And then you have this 90-degree bend right here in the pubic bone. And what do we call a part of a bone that comes off at a 90-degree angle? A ramus. So here is the superior ramus of the pubic bone, and then down over here is the inferior ramus of the pubic bone. And then here is the ischial ramus, which is kind of coursing anteriorly and articulating with the pubic bone. And I've never seen this line of fusion right here, but you can look at some bones in lab and see if you can see it. All right, so in lab, make sure you pick this bone up, turn it all around, place it on your body the way that it fits, right? It will help you understand this picture, because if this is the first time you're looking at this bone from this two-dimensional picture, it's probably a nightmare in your mind because it's just too complicated just looking at a two-dimensional picture. It gets easier if you have the real bone in front of you. Because what you see on a medial view is a nice bowl right here. What do we call a bowl in anatomy? A fossa, right? And so this is holding abdominal organs, maybe pelvic organs in this area right here. So this is a part of the ala on the medial side, right? We call that the iliac fossa, right? And remember, the pubic bone is what, anterior or posterior? Pubic bone is anterior, so I see the anterior superior, anterior inferior iliac spine, okay? And then the ischium is going to be posterior, so here's the posterior superior, posterior inferior iliac spine. This is the surface that articulates with the sacrum. So an auricular surface is the same thing as an articular surface. And that's an immovable joint, a lot of collagen fibers, right? So it doesn't look smooth because these bones should never really be moving with respect to each other. They're just kind of glued in place. to make a nice, stable pelvic region. Okay, so that's the ascoxae that help make up the pelvic girdle. All right, if we look through the pelvis, so here's a pelvis. If we just look, make a nice mid-sagittal section through the pelvis, right, and look on either side, this right here is what we call the arcuate line. Do I have another better view? Arcuate line right through here. Let's go back. Let me go back. Right here. Here is the arcuate line. It kind of forms like a rim around the pelvis right here. Anything deep to this arcuate line, it's not labeled on this slide, right, is what we call the true pelvis. So here's the true pelvic cavity in this region down here. But what can you tell me about the ascoxae? Is there very much ascoxae superior to the arcuate line? Yeah, this whole ala is above it, okay? So probably back in time, there were two groups of people studying anatomy, and they said, oh, well, we're going to define the pelvis as being below the arcuate line. And then another group of scientists said, oh, you know what, but I kind of like the iliac crest as being the definition. Everything below the iliac crest down to the tip of the coccyx should really be called a pelvic cavity. But there's no clear line of demarcation between these two. So there were two groups of people, and finally they agreed, okay, hopefully without too much trouble, that there were going to be two kinds of pelvic cavities. The true pelvis is below the arcuate line. The false pelvis is from the region of the iliac crest over here. Okay, so the true pelvis is in this color, defined by the arcuate line. The false pelvis also includes this region right here from the iliac crest. All right, you see those two different regions right there? What else can we say something about the pelvis? Oh, let me flip back a couple slides. Pubic symphysis, I didn't mention it, right? Pubic symphysis right here, that's fibrocartilage. That's very similar to the meniscus that's in your knee. That's a pretty tough cartilage. But under certain circumstances, it dissolves away. And what circumstance can anybody think of? When would it be good for that pubic symphysis to dissolve away? Yeah, during parturition, right? So that the pelvic bones can actually separate. That enlarges the birth canal, makes delivery a lot easier when that happens, okay, and then there are modifications to the pelvis based on gender that we'll talk about in lab, right, that enlarges the pelvic outlet for parturition, right, and then after parturition, then the pubic symphysis kind of reforms the pelvic bones, the pubic bones come back together, and it reseals this joint right here, mostly. Not exactly the way it was, but mostly, okay? Now, guys can have the same thing happen without this pubic symphysis. I guess females, too, that can happen with, but typically this is more common for men. For instance, when what? When you go through the handlebars on a motorcycle, okay, this pubic arch separates. So, I don't know, you guys that still like to ride motorcycles. Got to be careful out there. All right, so what have we been looking at? Axial skeleton or appendicular skeleton? Appendicular skeleton, right? The ascoxae right here. And what particular part of the appendicular skeleton? It's the pelvic girdle made up of the ascoxae, right? All right, so let's add in some other bones to this. Namely, all right, this one right here. All right, so what region of the body are we in now? Okay, what region of the body? I heard leg. Maybe I could hear a better. Thigh, that's right, because between your hip and your knee is your thigh. All right, so we got to be really precise in that language in here, unfortunately. Otherwise, you would maybe want to say lower appendage. That's fine. Lower appendage includes your thigh as well as your leg, which is between your knee and your ankle. So let's look at the bone. How many bones do you have in your thigh?
One.
Right here? I would say one. Okay, here's maybe a little complication. I don't know where people actually put this bone. But you do have a kneecap, right? That's called a patella. It's a funny little bone because it's a sesamoid bone. What does a sesamoid bone mean? It's completely surrounded by tendon, right? So, yeah, it's it's within a tendon someplace. A sesamoid bone is within a tendon. You don't have many of those in your body, but it helps stabilize the knee joint. The tip of the patella is the apex. The base is the superior part. Can you see it's kind of triangular shaped right here? The anterior surface is very rough because that's the part that attaches to tendons and ligaments that span across the knee. And the posterior surface right here is going to be really smooth. There's a depression articulating surface, and if it's an articulating surface that forms a depression, we like to call it a facet, right? So you have the facets that articulate with the femur on the posterior part. And it's not a very strong bone, and that thing can fracture too, right, if you hit your knee really, really hard, like when you fall. That's not a good bone to fracture. Okay, so here is the long bone in the thigh. You got a nice head right here. It's a relatively large part of the femur, and it is smooth. So that's the articulating surface. Now, why is his head so big? Because the acetabulum is what? It's deep, right? So it accepts the whole head of the femur. And then this narrowing distal to the head, we call that the neck. And I suppose if a femur is going to fracture, it wouldn't really fracture in this region here, but the neck is kind of long and narrow, so femoral fractures can occur in the neck, so we don't really call this surgical or anatomic neck like in the humerus. The other kind of interesting feature on the head of the femur is this little pit in the head. We call that the fovea capitis. And this little pit, which you can barely see in lab. See, there's just a little dimple, but there's a little pit right here. And this is for an attachment of a ligament that goes from the head of the femur all the way into the acetabulum, so that makes the hip joint even stronger. And there's a blood vessel that courses with that ligament that brings oxygen and nutrients to the head of the femur, because remember, this femur here is a living organ. There's living cells in there that maintain its shape. Right? Sometimes that ligament degenerates, maybe due to hip trauma or to other kinds of conditions, and that damages that blood vessel. So guess what happens to the head of the femur when that blood vessel gets damaged? Well, then it dies, and then it gets dissolved away just like any bone in your body would, and then you're left with this jagged edge of a femur grinding away inside the acetabulum. And you can imagine it's not a very pretty picture, and it probably hurts like what? Hurts like hell when that happens. So then you need an artificial hip. There was a professional athlete. I should actually pull up a YouTube clip probably. There was a professional athlete who played football. And he was a running back. And he was so good, he played professional baseball at the same time, which is phenomenal, right? And somebody tackled him really hard on the hip, damaged that blood vessel, and his femur started to degenerate. And he needed a hip replacement. So he had a prosthetic hip. And after that surgery, he was such an amazing athlete that he could still play professional sports with a bionic hip. Not football, because he didn't want to damage the hip again, but he went back and played baseball. Does anybody know who that was? Yeah, Bo Jackson. Somebody knows up over there. Okay, so maybe YouTube Bo Jackson and look at some of his amazing athletic abilities. Pre-artificial hip and post-artificial hip. Pretty amazing. All right, so just as in the humerus, there are tubercles for muscle attachment. There are two bony processes, but they're not called tubercles because they're really big and massive. These are called trochanters, greater trochanter, lesser trochanters. And then down the diaphysis, there's a line that we call the linea aspera, and it's a rough raised surface that's very long. Again, that's for muscle attachment. And down at the distal epiphysis, we have some condylar surfaces. We've got a medial and lateral condyle. How are you going to know which one is medial and lateral? It's easy. By the arrangement or the location of the head of the femur. The head is going to be pointing which way? Medially, because it's going to be attaching to your body. So here is the medial condyle, here's the lateral condyle, and then bony ridges above condyles are called epicondyles, right? So we have the medial epicondyle, lateral epicondyle here. We've got a notch between the condyles, and so we call that the intercondylar notch, or you could call it intercondylar fossa. Everybody would know what you're talking about. This is the posterior view. Here's the anterior view, because the articulating surface proceeds a little bit further up toward the diaphysis, because what bone is articulating in this region right here on the anterior side of your knee? That's your patella, right? So here is the articulating surfaces. Oh, it says patellar surface right there. All right, so femur is not too difficult to see. It's the largest bone in your body. All right, now that takes us to what part?
The leg.
How many bones in your leg? Just like your forearm, right? There's going to be a medial and lateral one. For the leg, it's a little bit more difficult to remember which one's medial and lateral. But let's just go back and review in the forearm. Which one is lateral in the forearm? That is the radius. The medial bone is the ulna. Because remember, when you take somebody's pulse, that's the radial pulse. It's the radial artery that courses along down the radius bone. In the leg, it's a little bit more difficult. It's just brute memorization. I don't know an easy way to remember this. The medial bone is the tibia. The lateral bone is the fibula. And if you ever find anybody to tell you an easy way to remember that, let me know. I'd be glad to tell you. The tibia is bigger. I would agree with that. T is the thick one, okay? But you still got to know medial and lateral. Lateral, medial, lateral, and the T's don't line up, yeah? The tibia is medial, fibula is lateral. Okay? One way that you can tell during a test is palpate with your fingertips. Okay? You can reach down to your leg and you can feel the tibia. There's not a lot of muscle around it, especially this anterior crest or anterior border is just right underneath your skin. So whenever you hit your shin bone, which is the tibia right here, you're just contusing that part of the tibia. It hurts really bad because there's no muscle protecting it. All right? And so you can feel this whole edge very easily. And then if you move laterally, there's so much muscle, you can't feel the fibula at all. It's just surrounded by too much muscle. So that might work on a practicum or a test, okay, just by palpation. All right, on the proximal epiphysis, you got the condylar surfaces. You've got a medial condyle and lateral condyle over here. That's why you got to know which bone is medial and lateral in the leg, because you got a medial condyle, lateral condyle. When we get to the knee joint, we got ligaments that we want to know about, like the medial collateral ligament, lateral collateral ligament. So we got to know what's medial and lateral at the knee. And then we have this intercondylar eminence. Again, for attachment point of some more ligaments, like the cruciate ligaments. Hopefully you guys don't know anything about those ligaments before you took an anatomy class. Because if you do, guess what that means? Maybe you had to talk to a surgeon at one point in time, right, to rebuild a knee. But if you're just learning about it right now, that's great, because it's a nice joint to know a lot about. Here is a process called the tibial tuberosity. That's an attachment point for muscles that are way up in the thigh. All right, then we said on the diaphysis you have this anterior border. The fibula is pretty nondescript, but you have the ankle bones, which are prominent bony features before you get to the ankle, and they're called malleoli. Here's the medial malleolus. Here's the lateral malleolus on the fibula. So again, you got to know fibula is lateral because it has the lateral malleolus. On a practicum, you don't want to say, oh, this is the medial malleolus. Well, you're close, but that would be wrong, unfortunately, because it's what? The lateral malleolus. Medial malleolus is on the tibia. Maybe if you said it really fast 50 times, it will be easier to remember. Medial malleolus, tibia. Medial malleolus. That would be really hard to say that 50 times in a hurry. Okay. All right, so that's four bones in your leg. Before I go, there is an interosseous membrane. All right, so this is a bone. This is dense, regular connective tissue, bone-to-bone connection. What do we call bone-to-bone connection of dense, regular connective tissue? What do we call that? I haven't mentioned it today, but it was a part of the skeletal system that I mentioned probably before the last test, which was like a couple weeks ago already. Remember the components of the skeletal system? You got bone, you got cartilage, and then the last thing was ligaments. So this is a bone-to-bone connection. This is a ligament right here. All right, but it's a freely movable joint. This ligament it stabilizes the joint just a little bit, and we call it the interosseous membrane. Just like in the forearm, there's an interosseous membrane between the radius and the ulna. just marginally stabilizes those joints. All right, which then takes us to the foot. Now, can you tell me the three groups of bones that you have in a hand? You've got carpals in the wrist. You got, in the hand proper, you've got metacarpals. And then in the digits, you have phalanges. Let's see if I got that right. In the wrist, you've got carpals in the hand. I didn't have it right. Good thing we're going over this again. Okay, in the wrist, you have carpals. In the hand, you've got metacarpals, and in the digits, you've got phalanges. Okay, so that's the hand. Now, what about the foot? A little bit of difference. All right, in the ankle, you don't have carpals, you have tarsals. Okay, and then in the foot proper, you have metatarsals, and then the digits are made up of phalanges. And in the ankle, there are two important bones that I want you to know. In the wrist, there's only one. Anybody remember the one in the wrist that I wanted you to know? Scaphoid, okay. But in the ankle, there are two. And one is a big, massive bone that supports all of your body weight when you're running or walking, and that is the calcaneus, right? So that's got to be a big, strong bone, and indeed it is. And then the one that's superior to it is the talus, and the talus is the bone that forms the joint between the tibia and fibula. So that's another important bone. All the rest you don't have to know, but if you're interested in knowing the names of these, all right, won't be too painful, won't hurt you at all. But those are the two important ones for this particular class. All right, calcaneus and talus. Those are what kind of bones? They belong to which group? Tarsals. Okay. And then, distal to that, you have metatarsals. And again, how many do you have? Five, corresponding, because you have five digits. That's interesting. If somebody has polydactyly, yeah, it's more than five. They have more than five digits. Do they have more than five metatarsals or metacarpals? I don't know. Somebody should take a look on Google and find that out. Let me know. Probably, I would guess. Maybe. Get a plain film. We'll take a look at it. All right, so the metatarsals, again, starting with the great toe, that's number one, right, out to number five. So what's the name of this bone right here? If you were to label this, if that was a question on a practicum, or this is an exam figure, you would say what? This is number four metatarsal. And you could tell this is not a hand, so it's not a metacarpal, right? All right, and then the digits, the bones in the digits are named exactly like in the hand, so that's pretty easy. All right, in the great digit, you just have two. You got distal and proximal phalanx, and then all the rest have three. Like, what is the name of this bone right here that I have the cursor hovering over? Third middle phalanx. And if you want to say the foot, that's good, but always read the question to see what kind of information is required. All right, so that is most everything for the appendicular skeleton. You do have some arches in the foot. You do have three arches. All right, so you've got a longitudinal arch right here from posterior to anterior. All right, you've got a transverse, and there's even a medial longitudinal arch. And the arch is in your foot to help distribute the shock of transferring body weight to the foot as you're walking or running. And so you have muscles and ligaments that hold the foot in this particular arch, and the arch moves a little bit to absorb that shock when you're walking and running. When you're flat-footed, well, then it has a tendency to wear all these joints down, and that shock can be transmitted to the knee, and that shock can be transmitted up into the sacroiliac joint, up into the vertebral column. So people might have back problems and knee problems if they're flat-footed and if it's not corrected and they're doing certain kinds of activities. All right, so if you're sedentary all the time, then maybe it's not such a big deal. But if you're on your feet all day long, then that's a whole different kind of scenario. Okay, and then somebody should have the proper kind of support built into their shoes for that to happen, okay, to support their weight properly. And that might take some of those problems away. And Do we have any polydactyly here? No. Oh, wait. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. No. Okay. Okay. Okay, that's a little bit different condition. Ah, hip dysplasia. Oh, look what's missing here. Oh, I'm sorry to see that. Have not had a hip replacement yet. Okay, but the head of the femur is dissolved away in this particular circumstance. So this is a really, depending on other things of this person, this would be a good candidate. What other things would a patient have to comply with before anybody, a health plan, would pay for a hip replacement surgery? Yeah, weight, age might be a consideration, okay, but weight as well, okay? If somebody is obese, then they're not going to be a candidate for hip replacement surgery, okay, because it just won't take. All right, so that's it for today's lecture. What we're going to do next time are articulations or joints. Now, before you go, it's just a little bit early. Here's the sign-in sheet for today. So maybe I went through that a little fast, so I got to ask for questions. Anybody have any questions? Okay, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet before you take off. And on the tibia, yeah, yeah. That's like your shin bone right there. All right, let's see if the recorder works. Looks like it.